Your smartphone may be doing things behind your back. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We're talking technology today with Iowa State University computer consultant Jeff Ballvans. There have long been privacy concerns when it comes to cell phones, but smartphones have made it even harder to protect yourself. That cool new app you downloaded may be mining your information. And while your smartphone may be spying on you, hackers are posing new threats. Some hackers have developed new techniques for getting information from corporations, and others have the Department of Homeland Security scrambling to protect power plants and other critical operations from a new computer worm. We'll cover those topics and take your questions. 866-780-9100, or you can send email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Join us after this news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. We are talking technology today with Jeff Ballvans, computer consultant at Iowa State University. That cool new app on your smartphone may be mining your information. Hackers are posing new threats, as they are prone to do. Some hackers have developed new techniques for getting information from corporations, and others have the Department of Homeland Security scrambling to protect power plants. Google has pulled the plug on Wave, and the FCC has ruffled some feathers by having closed-door talks on net neutrality. In the next hour, we'll talk about all of those topics, and we'll talk about what you'd want to talk about. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning.
How are you today?
I'm doing fine.
Great. Thanks so much for being here. Let's talk about these smartphones and data mining. Actually, the iPhone seems to have more trouble with this than some of the other smartphones.
Well, that's true to some extent. The iPhone has a number of apps. The Androids seem to be the ones that have the most well-documented features, but the iPhone stuff isn't immune either.
So what's going on? What are these apps doing?
Well, basically, a smartphone is more powerful than the computers we had a few years ago. So the same kind of things can be done with a smartphone that can be done with any other computer. You can plant malicious software in them to mine data, to find out things that you enter. If you're using a web browser, you're going to be entering that usernames and passwords. You're going to be entering credit card numbers. The other cool thing, of course, that you can do with a smartphone is that if you have access to the GPS features in the phone, many of them have that capability. You can tell where that phone is. So you not only know a person's personal information, but you know their location, their position. When the iPhones first came out, there was a nifty app that you could arrange that to have your friends show up on a Google map.
Right.
So you could see where all of your friends were. And that, for some people, that thought that was really cool. And for other people, that was kind of disturbing. Do I want everyone to know exactly where I am? Well, if you have a piece of malicious software, all of that data could be transmitted somewhere that you don't want it to be necessarily. And that's the kind of things that are starting to happen.
And what kind of apps should we be on the lookout for?
Well, that's kind of the tricky part. A lot of the applications that we're seeing that happen with are free applications, particularly things like, screensavers. That didn't used to be a problem with a phone, but it is now. New desktop pictures. Things that are given away free. It's probably best to know where they come from. Who are these people? And especially to look for things like, is the source code for this application open? Is it available? Can we see it? That's kind of important.
Well, if the source code is open, most of us wouldn't have any idea what we were looking for. Is it just the fact that it's open that helps?
The fact that it's open helps because you may not be able to go through and look at the code, but other people will be.
Okay, so that would protect you to some degree. And the article that you drew my attention to in InfoWorld did say that iPhones are showing more trouble with apps that have these security issues. Is that a newer thing to iPhones?
Well, that is a new thing to iPhones because of the way that applications are delivered to iPhones. The iPhone can only get its applications through the App Store. And Apple keeps a pretty tight rein on those. If they don't meet Apple standards for one reason or another, including some very trivial-looking reasons, they get nailed. They don't make it into the App Store. They're removed. And so in some respects, it's just Apple having to cope with its success. They've got thousands of applications out there, and do they have time to properly vet all the applications before they go on sale?
Well, data from your smartphone has been in the news quite a lot lately because the United Arab Emirates has announced that people cannot use BlackBerries within the country. It looks like Saudi Arabia is also preparing to block BlackBerry service because of the information that can be collected and mined through BlackBerry. So that seems to be a concern that's crossing all applications or all platforms right now.
That's part of the reason those countries are blocking BlackBerries. But I think the major reason those countries are blocking BlackBerries is because BlackBerry does have a very strong encryption system. It allows you to send messages that no one but the recipient can understand. And a lot of governments are very uncomfortable with that.
Well, that makes sense. I want to move on to a consumer topic, which is that Android-based phones have now passed iPhones among shoppers for the first time. And that sounds really significant, but is it? Because Android is a platform that's used on a lot of different phones, so we're not talking about a specific model of phone that's outselling iPhone.
That's right. There are a wide variety of manufacturers that are using it. Motorola uses Android. HTC uses Android. Samsung uses Android. So it's sort of a more the iPhone is a rifle shot. It's a single manufacturer, whereas Android is a large number of manufacturers. Nevertheless, I think it's significant because the more phones that you're seeing on the market, the more applications will become available for them. And I think that's important.
All right. Fred is on the line in Poweshiek County. Let's go to Fred. Hello, Fred.
Good morning. Yeah, Big Brother is always watching.
And some of us seem to be okay with that. So.
Yeah, but you know, once you say something, you can't take it back. It's just like gossip. You know, you call somebody a blank, and then you can't take it back. My question is, I heard that the DNR during deer hunting season is monitoring the cell phones and probably looking for certain words in case there are a group of individuals that are out there trying to get a certain nice buck. And is that working?
Well, it's the thing is, it's very difficult to monitor cell phone traffic. As far as I know, there's nothing like that. Somebody at the DNR would have to confirm that or deny it, but it seems unlikely. It's a little like the deal that we have. People always ask us at the university, well, do you read all the email addresses, all the emails? Well, there are a million and a half a week. We have people who are assigned to do that full time. No, we don't do that because the scope of the project is way too large.
Well, and I think the DNR has recently been talking about how incredibly tight their budgets are. So it would be very surprising if they had the wherewithal to monitor cell phones.
Yeah.
But if a person is missing and they have a cell phone on them, can that the fact that they have that cell phone be used to find them?
As long as the phone is releasing that information. Yes, you can use. There are a couple of ways you can locate a phone from a cell phone. If it does have GPS capability and that information is there, for example, if that phone calls 911 and the receiving 911 station has E911 capability, they can pinpoint the location from the GPS information in the phone. The other way that you can do it is less accurate, but you can do it by triangulating signal between several cell phone towers and identify it that way.
Okay.
But it's probably, I would be surprised if the DNR was going to that extent.
All right, Fred, I hope that sets your fears at ease. Although when you were in your question, you were talking about people possibly hunting illegally. I hope nobody's doing that, but the DNR is probably not watching in that way. Tony is on the line from Des Moines. Hello, Tony.
Yes, first a comment. Fred's question suggests just how prevalent and powerful commercially available technology is today. Even apparently our domestic intelligence agencies are using private sector developed technology. And one application where it could show up I'm kind of concerned about is my hospital is using a Wi-Fi laptop that's given to patients when they check in to verify their information. Mm-hmm. And I'm concerned that these transmissions could be intercepted and then a hacker could have access to the hospital database. And I'm wondering how should I discuss this if I have an opportunity to talk to IT personnel at the hospital to assuage my concerns without violating what I would assume to be their terms of employment that restrict them from discussing security mm-hmm. policy.
Well, the things to ask if you wanted to ask, and I think these are going to be pretty common practice in hospital information technology systems, is are the if you're supplying wireless access to patients like that, and many hospitals do, I know Mary Greeley and Ames does, is that kept on a separate network? Are the secure information resources, file servers, and so on, are those kept on a firewalled separate network from the public access? And I know that's true here in Ames. Secondly, are they using proper encryption standards? There are several different levels of encryption that can be used on wireless communications on Wi-Fi, and they should be using the highest standard available. Some of the early encryption techniques have been easily cracked. The newer ones are much more difficult.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Tony. Do you feel like Tony's right to be concerned about that?
Well, I think it's something that should be of concern. If the people doing the IT at your hospital are practicing what we call due diligence, they should be fine.
Microsoft has shipped a patch for Windows. There was a shortcut bug that attackers have been exploiting for a number of weeks, and they have plugged that hole. Tell me what the problem was.
Well, the problem, as it turns out, was something very strange and very old. It goes back to early versions of Windows. Basically, there was a flaw in Windows that allowed a properly crafted shortcut file, the .lnk files, to execute programs at the level of the operating system, which is basically you have access to everything. And that had not been discovered for however long Windows has been out until recently. That flaw allows you to break into a machine, in effect, simply by plugging a proper USB disk or a rewritable CD and into the machine or through an open network share with minimal interaction by the user at all. You just have to open the window for the disk and it's in.
All right, and Windows has plugged that hole now. We can talk more about that in a moment. You're listening to Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. My guest today is Jeff Balvance, a computer consultant at Iowa State University. And you can join us, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and with me today is Jeff Balvance, a computer consultant at Iowa State University, and we're talking about technology. We'd love to hear from you. If you have questions or concerns or a cool gadget that you want to share, give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. So, Jeff, before the break, we were talking about a patch for a Windows shortcut bug that has been sent out from Microsoft. So for most Windows users, all we need to do is download new updates?
That's right. For most recent versions of Windows, all you really need to do is run Windows Update. If you don't have automatic updates configured already, just go ahead and go to one of the places you go. Windows Update should show up in System Tools. It should be in the Tools menu in Internet Explorer. And like I say, if you have automatic updates configured, it should start automatically. That's for recent versions of Windows. There are a couple of bugaboos in this, in that two versions of Windows that I think are still in fairly common use have just fallen off of support and gone through what Microsoft calls end of life. If you are still using either Windows 2000, any service pack level, or Windows XP Service Pack 2, or earlier. Those versions do not get an update. Those are officially end of life, and you need to move on. Now, if you still have Windows XP Service Pack 2, you're in good shape. You can go through Windows updates and update to Service Pack 3, and that will get you an update. Windows 2000 users, unfortunately,
it's time to upgrade.
It's time to move on to something else, yes.
Okay. You know, we've been talking a lot about, so far, about some of the more frightening issues. We're going to move on to talking about some new hacker technologies and techniques in a moment. And I don't want to engage in fear-mongering, but
that's
do you think we're focusing a little too much on some of the negatives? Because although there are frightening things that can happen, for the most part, people are not being preyed upon.
That's right. And in fact, there is a group of security people who have looked at the economics behind security and are going, you know, we spend a lot of time changing passwords on a regular basis and doing updates. And if we look at the money that we spend on security, it, for the most part, most of the time, dwarfs the amount of money that you lose from security breaches. Now, if you're a big corporation with egg on your face because you've lost 2 million people's credit card numbers, that's a little bit of a different case. But for many of us, security is not a big concern. On the other hand, like I always like to say, you're not paranoid if they really are out to get you. And there are people out there who want to steal your credit card numbers and
right.
other personal information. And they are working very hard at doing that. And they have a lot of money behind them now.
Justin is on the line in Davenport. Hello, Justin.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, guys. I had actually a comment about the security. I actually run a web development company, and it seems like a lot of people are very hesitant to put any kind of credit card information or whatever, make payments online. And I think they sometimes forget the point that a lot of times, you know, a lot of the real world transactions are being stolen, you know, from people just giving their credit card to the store or, you know, there's a risk doing it anywhere. And there is a lot of security online to take care of a lot of these things.
That's true. I mean, when you hand your credit card to a waiter, you make the assumption that the process of taking that card to the register, entering the information and bringing it back is secure. And if you don't see that happen, what's to say he can't copy all the numbers off and use your card?
Right. Well, in a lot of there have been scandals in many places where the problem is that your bill is kept open until you sign the receipt and put how much you'd like for a tip. And
right.
so even after your card has been returned to you, you still that bill can still be open and the tip can be inflated. So there's insecurity everywhere.
Sure.
But on the web, if you're using your credit card, what do you need to do to protect yourself?
Well, the biggest need is to make sure that the server that you're working with is secure. Make sure that the address says HTTPS at the beginning. That says it's using secure SSL. And that's a very good place to start and work with people that you trust.
Well, and a lot of places allow you to pay through PayPal, so you have your information in one place and you use that information to pay on a number of different sites. Do you think that that's an effective way to protect your information?
I think that's a good place to start. I use that extensively ourselves. My family has a business that uses PayPal as its primary payments system. And the nice thing is that the security with PayPal, to a greater extent, is their problem, not ours. And they do a much better job of it than we do.
Thanks a lot for your call, Justin. If you have a question or a concern or something you'd like to share, give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk. And now to return to the fear-mongering, hackers do have some new techniques. And I was reading about social engineering hackers. What are they?
Well, social engineering is really nothing new. We sometimes say that the weakest link in the security lies between the chair and the keyboard. The person that's there is very easy to trick into giving away personal information. The biggest example of that is the classical phishing email. There's a problem with your account. Would you please send us your username and password? Well, that's more than likely not your account, your internet service provider that's sending that out. That's somebody else that wants your username and password and will use that to get to use your account. You know, we say, AOL says, everybody, a lot of service providers say, we will never ask you for your password, either in email or over the phone. We don't need that. Well, the bad guys do. So if you see somebody asking for that, it's a pretty good chance that it's not somebody that's out to do you good. But there are all sorts of other information that can be garnered by proper social engineering. Walk in the door at a place with the right kind of uniform on, you get access to the building. And then once you're in the building, you know, good Unix admin will tell you, if I have access to your computer, if I can touch it, I have your information. There's nothing to that. So the whole social engineering hacking deals not with breaking into computers with software, but breaking into computers with crafty speech. Asking for your password. You know, tech support calls you and asks for your password. Well, tech support doesn't do that.
Right.
It shouldn't do that. But you'd be surprised how many people will hand it out. And if you can make it sound like you're someone in tech support, for example, it's amazing what details people will give about their computers. There was a recent test at the Black Hat convention that was recently held. They actually had people call different Fortune 500 companies and shoot for, stealing information from them as an example of the techniques that are used. And nobody did anything, threatening. Nobody used any fancy software, but they were able to get all sorts of useful information just by asking. Several years ago in London, they did a test and they were able to determine that in one company, at least a large percentage of people would trade their passwords for a candy bar.
Oh, no.
It was well over 50% would trade their password for a candy bar.
So don't do that.
Yeah, don't do that.
That's great advice to live by. We have Ray on the line in Mason City. Hello, Ray.
Hi. When you were talking a little while ago about Service Pack 3,
okay.
I have a friend and neighbor that does service work on computers.
Okay.
And he told me this a couple of years ago and still says that he downloaded Pack 3, and if you do certain operations on it, you can no longer use XP. You have to delete it in order to use XP. And he says the same, because it was always trying to get you to go to Vista. And Explorer 8 or 9, whatever it was,
mm-hmm.
He had the same things. You got into certain files of that or, uses of that, and it would, your XP was no good anymore.
Well, one of the things that Service Pack 3 does do is it uses what Windows calls genuine advantage. Service Pack 3 will only install if the Windows can be shown to be genuine Windows. Now, there are times when genuine Windows looks broken, and that can usually be fixed with a little help from Microsoft Tech Support, though.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Ray. We're talking technology today with computer consultant Jeff Ballvance, and we'd love to hear from you. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me today, Jeff Ballvance, computer consultant at Iowa State University. We are talking technology. We've been spending a lot of time talking about security concerns today, but we'd like to talk about whatever's on your mind. If you have any questions for Jeff, give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Jeff, Roy in Rolfe has a question. He says, Apple tells me I don't need antivirus software installed, but when I look at websites like McAfee, they do sell programs for Mac and say in so many words that it is needed. What's your advice?
Well, my advice, I guess, given the fact that there are two things going on. Number one, macOS is designed in such a way that it's a little harder for viruses to attack and spread it. Having said that, it is still possible to create malicious software that will attack a macOS 10 machine, and we have seen plenty of cases of that. So I guess in the long run, I would say that it's possible to infect a macOS 10 machine, and it's certainly worth looking at. We do use an antivirus on most of the machines here at Iowa State, Macintoshes included. It's a matter of personal preference, but I guess I would probably recommend it.
Okay. Has there been historically less of that kind of thing going on with Mac because it was a minority user base, or is it just because the OS is more difficult to get into?
I think those are the two simultaneous reasons. One, it's harder to attack a Mac OS X machine. That's not to say it's not possible, but they have been a lesser target. Now, what I think is most interesting is that the biggest growing segment of technology is not Mac or Windows right now. It's smartphones, and that's why the attention is being directed in that direction. And people are bringing out antivirus packages for your phone as well.
Well, and that brings us to another question from, this is from Chad in Dubuque, and he wants to know if there is an Android app that would protect his phone from security threats.
There are people who are selling antivirus packages, or actually not selling in this case. There is a company called Lookout that makes an application that will help protect Android phones. I think there may be a couple of others on the way if there aren't already there. Lookouts has some other nice tricks. It will back up your contacts so that it makes it easier to move to another phone or in the event that your phone dies and do some other things as well.
The number to call if you'd like to join our conversation is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We have spent a lot of today talking about security threats, but we can also talk about hardware and anything that's on your mind. So if you have a question for Jeff, do give us a call, 866-780-9100. And Rolf is on the line in Forest City. Hello, Rolf.
Hello, Jeff. My name is Rolf Anderson. I was a geek since 83 educated people on technology and real estate for years. But the last year and a half, I have been totally unplugged and have still survived.
Good.
But I have a question. I did a lot of business on PayPal over the years, and I'm aware of things like keyloggers and other forms of that. How secure is a secure site if you have a keylogger that's watching your strokes?
Well, that goes back definitely as a problem. If there is a program or a hardware device on your machine that's monitoring your keyboard, it doesn't matter how secure the site is because it's going to find it.
Will a virus program, a current virus program, find that keylogging program or similar program?
Many of them will. Again, it's the whole business of antivirus and anti-malware is a race. People develop the malicious software. The antivirus companies develop the tools to find them. New viruses are released virtually daily. I think Trend Micro once counted something like 20,000 new versions in a single day. It is a matter of a race against time. So there's a certain risk even if you have current antivirus and anti-spyware tools, there's a certain amount of risk that you will, in fact, have a keylogger on board.
And how a keylogger is a program that records your keystrokes.
That's right.
How would that get onto your computer?
Well, it would get onto the computer any way that a virus or worm would do. It could use the recent vulnerability to get on from a USB stick or from another computer on a network. It could be transmitted by following a link in an email. It could be picked up as part of a malicious website or even a malicious advertisement on a normal website. There are lots of vectors that can be used to drop software on your computer.
All right. And Rolf, are you plugging?
A lot of divorces also.
Are you plugging back in now if you've been unplugged for the last year and a half?
Well, I finally have a Gmail account now, and I am easing back into it. But I'm very cynical, even after I was in the business for so long. But if I buy something online now, I send a cashier's check.
All right.
That's how cynical I've gotten. But I still believe in it, but I'm still just worried about the security of passwords and that type of thing.
Are you so cynical because you've been burned in the past?
No, but recently my daughter was. But I've just been, I'm aware of the security issues, and people say it's secure, and I just sometimes, these hackers now are no longer garage people. They are cartels. They are huge organizations that have resources that scare me.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Rolf.
You're welcome. Thank you, Jeff.
You're welcome.
The number to call if you'd like to join our conversation is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, and you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And I was reading the news this morning, and I found an article about some secret meetings on net neutrality that have been taking place. As we know, the FCC has spent a lot of time having meetings on net neutrality without much success. So now the Federal Communications Commission chairman has gotten together a number of big players in the net world. So handpicking Google, AT&T, Verizon, and Skype for 7 closed-door meetings that continue this week at the FCC. This has created a lot of controversy because having these big players in on the talks may leave the little guy behind. But first of all, for people who don't follow along with net neutrality, what's the big issue? What's at stake?
Well, the big issue involving net neutrality is the idea that everyone should have equal access to the Internet. If I am a website developer who's putting together a small site for a small business, I should have just as much right to the bandwidth to your computer as a big player like Google or Disney. And that's the issue. What a lot of Internet service providers would like to be able to do is say, you know, we can give your website premium access for a small fee. And when that happens, then say a movie site, a big movie site like, well, for example, say Blockbuster, bought into this and they paid your Internet service provider to say, all right, our packets are more important than this other guy's packets. And so they get a better bandwidth into your house than somebody else. And the Internet service providers would like that because it gets them more revenue. The big players would like that because it gets them more revenue. They can have better access and therefore be more competitive than you are. Of course, the little players are up in arms because they're going, hey, we don't want to get pushed out because we don't have as much money as
they Right. It would be giving a net monopoly
That's
to
right.
these big players.
It would be giving a net monopoly or oligopoly to the larger players.
So what's your take on secret talks with these major players?
Well, that's a really good question. I'd love to know what's behind those doors.
I think a lot of people would.
I think what may be happening, I know the Obama administration has at least given lip service to the idea of net neutrality. What might be happening in those doors is the FCC going in and saying, okay, look, you know, we know what you guys want. How are we going to resolve this? And that's something that might, the kind of deal they may need to make might not be possible to do in an open session.
Justin is on the line in Bettendorf, called 866-780-9100. Hello, Justin.
Yeah, actually, my question was on net neutrality. You guys have been covering it a little bit, but I was wondering whether Jeff thought our capitalistic system being what it is, if this is going to stand, if net neutrality will stand, or if these players will get involved, profit off of it.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, Justin.
Just the way the economic system is right now and the way the system of government is right now, I have to say I can't see net neutrality surviving. I don't like the sound of that, but I can't see that it's going to be something that will be tenable.
Do you think that the government, if they make a commitment to sustain net neutrality, do you think the government actually has control over the net?
That's another really good question. Do we have the tools that it takes to verify that? I'm not sure that they would have the ability to do that, even if they didn't. If they came out and said you had to do that.
All right. Ron is on the line from the Quad Cities on a different subject. Hello, Ron.
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I had a computer a couple of years ago that was taken to a shop. The shop was unable, they claimed, to repair it, but was able to provide a disk that purports to contain everything that all the information that was stored on the computer.
Okay.
And now, of course, I have another computer and wonder if I could make use of that disk to view what was there and perhaps download some of that information to my new computer. Of course, the background concern is whatever killed the old one might harm the new one.
Well, that's a really good question. And there are two questions to ask. First of all, what form is the information from the old computer in? If you pop that disk in and take a look at it, do you see folders? Do those folders look vaguely like the folder structure that you see on your hard drive? If that's the case, what you can do is pick and choose through those folders and only take the pieces that seem safe or important to you. If they backed up the entire hard drive, there's a lot of stuff on there, particularly in the program files and the Windows directories, that you probably don't care about on your new machine.
Right.
If the machine was Windows XP or newer, there's probably a directory on there called Documents and Settings, and in there you will find all the documents and settings files for each of the people who use that computer. If you carefully go through those and look at, for example, the Documents folder and the Desktop folder, that's where a lot of the information that you're looking for probably is. If you stay away from the program files and just take documents of the particular types that you normally use, you're probably fairly safe.
Well, the old computer was an XP, and I guess I'm hoping that I could be secure because, of course, I had viral protection on the old one, the XP, and, of course, continue to have viral protections in this newer unit.
Why did the old computer fail? Was it a problem with the hard drive? Was it a virus attack?
I had it in the shop for, it seems like, 10 days.
Okay.
And in the past, they had always been quite prompt in being able to, whatever small problem I might have had, but in those 10 days, they were unable, despite increased personnel looking at it, were unable to tell me what was wrong with it. And but at any rate, for $60, they gave me a disk.
That had the old data on it. Okay.
But good luck.
You know, there are a couple of things that could be a problem with it. One, if it was a problem with the hardware, particularly something in the motherboard, that's when you lose a motherboard, especially on an older machine, that's pretty much a sign that it's time to toss the machine and start over. If you've got a relatively new machine, especially if it's still under warranty, well, you replace the motherboard and you go on. If the hard drive was failing, that's usually an excuse for a new hard drive, but not usually an excuse to replace the machine. There must have been something pretty serious wrong with it. And I would ask them, why did this fail? What were the things that failed that led you to say that it wasn't repairable?
All right. Well, good luck with that, Ron. And we have Dan on the line from Fairfield. He wants to return to the net neutrality conversation. Hi, Dan.
How are we doing?
Great.
Good. It seems like this net neutrality that everybody's talking about seems to be a sort of a shorthand for the status quo. Are we talking about prioritization of traffic when we say net lack of net neutrality, or that breaking net neutrality would allow prioritization of traffic?
That is correct. What we're saying is that some traffic is better than others, and it should get there more rapidly or with more bandwidth than others.
So you're doing that by marking the packets in the traffic flow?
That's right. You would have your routers look at the traffic and give higher priority to packets from different locations.
Well, then, if you wanted to have what I guess the quote-unquote converged network with voice and video, wouldn't that be preferable to be able to mark that traffic?
Well, that is, in fact, one of the problems. It would be preferable if you could give priority to streaming traffic, where if you're transmitting a video stream or transmitting an audio stream, it's good to have those priority. What I think people are worried about in the whole net neutrality conversation is that, say, let's say that ABC's stream should have a higher priority than NPR's stream.
Isn't that an issue only when there's congestion, when there's more traffic trying to flow down the pipe than the pipe can handle?
Theoretically, yes. If you get to the last mile, if you get to the point where you're delivering traffic via a 1.5 megabit VPN or a DSL connection to a household, that pipe is almost always congested.
Ah, okay.
All right. Does that answer your question, Dan?
Yes. Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you very much for your call. And we probably have time for a couple more calls. 866-780-9100 is the number. We've got Rob on the line in the Quad Cities. Hello, Rob.
Yeah. Good afternoon. How are you guys doing?
Great. What would you like to talk about?
Well, my question concerns, I've got a lot of files on my laptop spread across the hard drive in multiple folders that I would like to sync to my smartphone so that I can have access to those files even when I don't have my laptop handy. And so far, a lot of the syncing software I've looked at causes me to have to make copies of those files and put them in a common folder or something like that. And in my case, that adds up to a gigabyte or more, and that's just not feasible. And I was wondering if you guys had any suggestions for a piece of software that can help me go find all these files, point to them at least, and then link to my smartphone.
Wow. I don't have a recommendation for such a thing. I mean, maybe that somebody can give us an advice. Other than recommending that you organize your files more neatly, I don't really have a good answer.
I'm sure that's not the answer Rob
was
looking for.
That's probably not the answer you're looking for, because you have very good reasons for putting your files where they are. I'm sorry, I don't have a good answer for that one.
All right. Well, I'm sorry we couldn't be more help, Rob. If somebody else has a great idea for Rob, give us a call, 866-780-9100. Reading the tech news this morning, another thing that I saw is that Google Wave is now a thing of the past.
That's right. It was a really great idea, but like a lot of Google Labs projects, you know, this is one of the part of Google's philosophy. We try things. And they don't always work out the way we expect them to, or we hope them to. And when that happens, we make them go away. And that's what happened to Wave. There were, in many respects, there were privacy concerns in Wave because of the way that information was being shared. And the whole idea of the way things work just didn't catch on.
Well, and Wave was a program that was supposed to let people chat, share files, and collaborate on documents in real time. So you could actually see what someone else was typing on a document as they typed it.
And the thing is, even though Wave died, a lot of that technology is working its way into other applications. The whole threaded conversation idea is part of Google Mail. Being able to see other people typing on a document, those collaboration tools are working into Docs. So it wasn't a complete loss.
Well, and Google has actually made some of that code available as open source as well.
That's right. So, you know, other people can adopt the ideas from Wave. And so, you know, it's one of those things that Google does. You know, there are many services and products that Google has thrown out into the labs and said, let's look at this and see what happens. And the fact that you fail sometimes, the fact that a project turns into something that you don't keep doesn't necessarily mean that you're a failure. It just means that you've learned some things.
Brian from Cedar Rapids is on the line. Hello, Brian.
Yes, I actually had a comment for the guy who was just on about the program for a smartphone.
Oh, good.
It's not for an actual program. I would say Google search for a forum, because chances are if you've had the problem, someone else has, and it seems to have worked out for pieces of programming that I've had before.
All right, so you don't have the silver bullet, but you think somebody out there might have it.
Oh, yeah. Well, chances are some sort of program for it, so... Google's always helped me, though. Anytime I needed something obscure, someone else had some suggestions on any kind of forum for that.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Brian.
Yeah, Google has
Google
has always been the secret of my success. I really don't know anything. I just know how to search.
I think that's the secret to a lot of success. It makes elementary school a lot less valuable, I guess, now. Right?
Well, you still have to be able to type.
Right. All right. Well, Jeff, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Jeff Balvance is a computer consultant at Iowa State University. He joins us once a month to talk technology issues with you. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Rosalind Sixby. Technical support from Michael Yeager in Ames today. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available anytime at iowapublicradio.org. And we'd love to hear from you. If you have an idea for something you'd like to hear on the show, or you know somebody with a great story to tell, send us email, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, it's Horticulture Day. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.